From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Conservative Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito made remarks to the Federalist Society last week that were brazenly partisan and shocked legal observers. Among his controversial statements was that the conservative organization that invited him faced, quote, harassment and retaliation for saying anything that departs from the law school orthodoxy. The Federalist Society is notorious for feeding extremist, right-wing, homophobic, anti-abortion, anti-worker, or anti-immigrant judges to Republicans for court appointments. Alito also denounced the fact that Christian churches were forced to abide by the same shelter-in-place orders that everyone else did, and he made these regressive remarks about same-sex marriage.
You can't say that marriage is a union between one man and one woman. Until very recently, that's what the vast majority of Americans thought. Now it's considered bigotry. That this would happen after our decision in Obergefell should not have come as a surprise. Yes, the opinion of the court included words meant to calm the fears of those who cling to traditional views on marriage. But I could see, and so did the other justices in dissent, where the decision would lead. I wrote the following. I assume that those who cling to old beliefs will be able to whisper their thoughts in the recesses of their homes. But if they repeat those views in public, they will risk being labeled as bigots and treated as such by governments, employers, and schools. That is just what is coming to pass. One of the great challenges for the Supreme Court going forward will be to protect freedom of speech. Although that freedom is falling out of favor in some circles, we need to do whatever we can to prevent it from becoming a second-tier constitutional right.
And that is Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito last week giving an unabashedly partisan speech at a time when conservatives have a supermajority on the court. One commentator called the speech a, quote, judicial equivalent of a Trump rally. Alito has fueled a growing concern that the nation's highest court is deeply biased. My guest is Lena Zwarenstein. She is the Fair Courts Campaign Director of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Welcome to the program, Lena.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali. I appreciate it.
How unusual is it for a sitting Supreme Court justice to give a public speech that is so overtly biased?
It is unusual. I think the fact that he was so out there in making the comments in which he did was really, really striking to me. And obviously, as you mentioned earlier, a number of other legal observers. He started off his remarks incredibly defensive, saying he doesn't want anyone to misconstrue them, except what he did was he went on a tirade about, you know, things such as same-sex marriage, about things about the pandemic and so on. And he really laid out for the entire world really what he thinks about decisions that the Supreme Court has handed down, and honestly has paved the way for, I think, advocates who will eventually come in from the court, how he may view those issues in the future as well.
So let's talk about some of the statements that he made specifically regarding same-sex marriage. It sounded like he was simply casting the right to espouse homophobia as being protected by free speech rights, that the First Amendment is more important than, you know, people to live free of discrimination if they're members of the LGBTQ community. Is that, you know, how do you respond to that?
I think it is really appalling that he would, you know, take a Supreme Court case and a majority opinion that has said there is such a thing in this country as marriage equality, people can marry who they love, and said basically that, yes, people's, you know, the what words that they use and the fact that they can be incredibly homophobic means more than somebody's ability to live their life in full dignity. What I think is really interesting in some of the comments that he made really are striking and shocking for many of us. So while we do strongly believe that everyone should have the ability to freely live, and that is with their faith or without, you know, any faith at all, really, it is the opportunity for people to live in full dignity in this country. And that means being able to marry who you want to marry, being able to seek resources in your community, whether that is the person who bakes your wedding cake or the photographs and so on and so forth. But what he is saying is that those public accommodations should not be available to the LGBTQ community. And he really thinks that we should be actually going back in time. And it's really, really shocking to me that that kind of conversation can happen for our LGBTQ community. But it's the same type of argument that one would make having, had to desegregate the public accommodations previously. You know, people would hopefully no longer say that is it acceptable to deny services to people who, because of their skin color. However, they are willing to do so because of the LGBTQ status, and that's just not acceptable.
So we also see the statements that Alito made around shelter in place or stay at home orders. And this has been a big issue around the country as the pandemic raged around the nation and states enacted restrictions. Churches didn't want to be held to the same standards as everyone else, arguing that their right to congregate somehow should be allowed, that it was more important than people being able to do other things, as if a virus would simply choose to not spread in the confines of a church like it would in a movie theater. And Samuel Alito appeared to throw some red meat to that faction of Americans, this deeply conservative, fundamentalist, Christian, evangelical Trump base, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, many houses of worship totally understood and complied with the public health orders that really are trying to help prevent the spread of this very deadly and devastating pandemic. And the fact that he did exactly what you said and throw meat out there is incredibly troubling. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is in his speech, but also what we have seen in the opinions of many of the nominees that Trump has put on the lower courts in a lot of their opinions, is trying to pave the way for people to be able to continue to discriminate on using religion as a license to do so. And that is really, really incredibly troubling for us. Oh, I was just going to say one other thing that I think is important to note, in Justice Alito's speech is that he felt completely, unconstrained. He was not held back in making the comments that he did. And I think that really is a sign that he feels emboldened to do so. As you started at the top, there is a super conservative majority in our Supreme Court, one that is wildly out of step with the public that we have here. And that emboldenment, I think, is allowing them to make, in Justice Alito in this case, to make these really, really bold claims that are outwardly partisan and incredibly harmful for many people. What's possible we could be doing, though, is extending the code of conduct. So the Supreme Court currently is not bound by a code of conduct, one that a lot of judges, the lower courts are, and that is, in terms of what they're able to say or the impartiality in which that they even, try to make sure that there's not even an appearance of impartiality.
So lower court judges are bound by this code, but our highest court judges aren't?
That's correct. So
wow.
It is really, really telling. And I think, what we heard from Justice Alito last week is kind of an amazing, contrast to what we heard of Judge, now Justice Barrett, just in her confirmation hearing. Justice Barrett was incredibly evasive in answering questions about her view of the law when it came to issues related to even the peaceful transfer of power that presidents should be able to commit to, or to the fact that climate change is real. She said she wouldn't weigh in because she doesn't want to give an appearance of partiality on any issues that could come before the courts. And then a month later, Justice Alito, now her colleague on the Supreme Court, is going off saying exactly what he thinks about those particular issues. And so there really isn't honesty there. And I do think the fact that there isn't a code of conduct for Supreme Court justices is something that we can hopefully rectify, in the coming years, that there is more transparency with the court. It's certainly helpful sometimes to know exactly what people and the judges and justices think. However, in a situation like this, it is incredibly harmful to the court that their integrity is really in question, as well as their independence, by the comments that Justice Alito made last week.
He was giving a talk to the Federalist Society, and he said during that talk that the Federalist Society faces harassment and retaliation for saying anything that departs from the law school orthodoxy. What was he referring to? And give us that background in terms of what impact this group, the Federalist Society, that many Americans have probably never heard of, has had on both the Supreme Court and lower courts.
The Federal Society is a very small sector of the legal community and one that is outsized in terms of especially the judicial nominations process. And what he was doing was really evoking what are a lot of the foundings of the Federalist Society. So in response to the civil rights movement and the progress that people had made in terms of voting rights and the ability to access, you know, public services and making sure that that was, you know, possible for all people in this country, especially, you know, Black and Brown people who had been historically not allowed into those services, whether that was because of school segregation and so on, there was a large conservative movement that was founded. And a lot of those pillars of what that meant was to do things like discredit academia and discredit the media, and also to do more to take over the courts, because you can put in lifetime appointments people who will do your bidding over the long term and for generations to come. So when he was talking about, you know, the harassment, his words, not mine, that the Federalist Society face, a lot of that is in response to what they have been doing over the past few decades to discredit the progress that has made by putting people on the bench and in law schools and in key positions who have a very regressive vision of the law, one that does not allow for full equality for women, for Black and Brown people, for LGBTQ people, and so on. And so this sort of ability to play the victim and saying that they have to be quiet because it's not cool to say what they're saying is one that, you know, we have heard for decades and decades to come, but it is part of the plan to really discredit academia, discredit the media, discredit a lot of folks who really do hold the majority view that, you know, civil and human rights should be for everybody. Our judges and law should be reflective of the current society that we live in, not one that was, you know, sort of enshrined back when the Constitution was written, but one that the Constitution really was meant to reflect in terms of the values that we have here.
And I understand that a number of the court's conservative justices are just members of the Federalist Society. Now, and Alito was not even appointed by Trump. He was appointed by George W. Bush. And then you had Neil Gorsuch, and you had Brett Kavanaugh, and of course, then the latest one, Amy Coney Barrett. I'm not sure if Barrett is a member of the society, but I imagine that she was on the list that the organization gave Trump, because they've literally fed these judges and Supreme Court justice nominees to Republican presidents. There are lists, and we're just talking about the Supreme Court, but there's hundreds of lower court federal judges that this organization also influences, right?
That's exactly right. On Tuesday, 224 lifetime confirmations will be the milestone that this administration reached. That it represents 30% of our circuit courts, which is that layer right below the Supreme Court, as well as 25% of the district courts. So by the end of the week, that will be 228. That is really astonishing. But like you said, that this is a real project for the Federalist Society to try to take over our courts with folks who are very reflective only of a small sliver of our country and of the legal community to make sure that they're on the bench for decades to come.
And so you're suggesting that there are going to be more judges installed even before the end of this week. That means Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who of course is the one who takes Trump's appointees or nominees who've been fed to Trump by the Federalist Society. McConnell ensures that they receive Senate confirmation hearings, and because Republicans control a majority in the Senate, they get pushed through regardless of what Democrats say. He, after the election, after it's clear Trump lost, and you know, after he has refused to consider a bill to help people who are struggling economically with the pandemic, has chosen to focus the Senate's time on packing the lower courts, right? There's no other way to do this. This is, he's, has been his agenda throughout the last 4 years and continues to be his agenda in the last month and a half of Trump's time in office.
That's exactly right. And it is really egregious that while this nation is suffering from a public health and economic crisis that is disproportionately impacting Black and Brown people, that they are so fixated on the courts and installing judges who will do harm to those very communities. It is absolutely appalling. It was remarkable, you know, with the unfortunate passing of Justice Ginsburg, that, you know, Senator McConnell got his entire caucus in line to rush through in 39 days from vacancy announcement to confirmation, now Justice Barrett to the court, in anticipation, in real desperation to make sure that they solidified that. But that is exactly what's happening also at the lower courts. This has been a real project and endeavor of Mitch McConnell to try to concentrate power while he can, because he knows that the courts will do his bidding for them for decades to come.
And this is becoming an issue in the Georgia Senate runoff races right now, because there are two seats that Democrats could win, which if they do, will give them just the barest majority on the Senate, only because Vice President Kamala Harris would be a tiebreaker. And Republicans are warning Georgia voters that Democrats want to pack the courts, and therefore they should not get those two Senate seats. But it has been the Republicans packing the courts. And that's what Joe Biden is also being accused of doing for the Supreme Court. He has said that he might consider adding more seats to the U.S. Supreme Court. Can the incoming Biden-Harris administration do anything about the conservative transformation of the American judiciary, whether it's lower courts or the nation's highest courts?
Yeah, it is imperative that on day one of their administration, that they have bold nominees who have a demonstrated commitment to civil and human rights, who are fair-minded, have a progressive vision of the law, and are actually reflective and representative of the amazing diversity we have in our country. And it would be incredibly helpful for them to have allies in the Senate, those who control the calendar, who gets a hearing, who can have a vote. Mitch McConnell has proven, you know, even what we saw with the historic obstruction of Merrick Garland, who was President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court in 2016, that he likely won't move forward any nominees. And that would be very, very harmful. But the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration, it is incumbent on them to make sure that courts and judges are a priority for them. Of course, we absolutely need COVID relief for our communities. We need to be making sure that we are passing things like the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and we need a Senate that will actually function and do its job. And we do need to modernize our courts, and that is with the types of judges who are actually reflective of this country. Unfortunately, what President Trump has done to our courts, of his 200 and what will be 28 nominees by the end of the week, nearly 90% of those nominees are white. And nearly 70 or wow. nearly 80% of them are male. We have a lot of work to do in order to make sure our courts even look like our communities. And so this really has to be a priority.
I mean, and that if one was looking for any indication about the Trump presidency being a white male supremacist presidency, there you have it. There is a very clear indication of how our courts, that were already not representative enough, have over the past 4 years become even less representative. Now, if it turns out that the Republicans retain control of the Senate next year, what can a Biden presidency do? I mean, obviously, there will be lower court vacancies. Biden will put forward nominees, and McConnell will, what, stall for 4 years and refuse to seat anyone?
It will be incumbent upon all of us to be as vocal as we have been for the past 4 years to fight for something. We were fighting for our democracy, and so we need to keep fighting. And I think the more we can compel this incoming administration, as well as our senators, to make sure that they are pushing forward really good, bold nominees, the better chances that we have in order to get anything done and get through. So it really is going to be incumbent upon us to do that. But I think that, you know, the types of messaging and signaling that this administration sends on day one is going to be incredibly sort of dependent on where we go from here. We have fought far too hard. And, you know, it feels like we have taken tremendous steps backwards. But I think what I've been so hopeful or gotten hope from was the ways in which the communities have really stepped forward that I think can springboard us into the future. Of course, you know, Mitch McConnell will do everything he can, but he really can't ignore the will of the people. So we have to keep on screaming about this and talking about it.
So, you know, if McConnell has his way, or I should say, before there are any more vacancies on the Supreme Court, or if Biden chooses to not add more seats, we're looking at a court where there are six conservatives, three liberals. Even if John Roberts decides to join the liberals on some votes, then we're looking at 5-4 decisions on many issues. We're looking at a potentially very dark time for cases approaching or coming before the Supreme Court now, even as we have a Democrat entering the White House.
That's right. And it is incredibly harrowing to be in this moment right now, knowing that so many people's rights are on the line. We had before the Trump administration significant progress we needed to make for everybody. And it feels like right now, it feels like we're going uphill battle, but we know that the fight for equal justice will be won for our entire life. And what that exactly looks like right now feels daunting, but I think at day by day, we see how important it is that courts are. One thing that I find tremendous encouragement by is just thinking about this most recent election, the one by which, you know, we have a president elect Biden and a vice president elect Harris. When doing the exit polling and talking about whether or not Supreme Court nominations were a factor, a majority of people who voted said, yes, it was a factor. And majority of them voted for President Biden, or now President-elect Biden. And that to me gives me a lot of hope that people do understand the ways in which whatever it is that they care passionately about, whether that is climate change, that is justice reform, that is voting rights, that that really is intrinsically linked to who sits on the bench in our courts and who has the ability to make those nominations really does depend or it is really important to how the judges would rule in the future and what our rights look like and how we're able to exercise them in the future. So I do have hope that people really do recognize this and will continue to fight for fair and just courts, because for far too long, you know, corporations have had way too much power in this, and it's time we, you know, it's going to be a long haul, but the people have spoken, and I think we need to keep speaking in order for them to become our court.
So let me just finally wrap up our conversation asking you to comment on a statement that Erwin Chemerinsky, UC Berkeley School of Law dean, wrote in the LA Times. He said, there's nothing wrong with Justice Alito telling the world his views. And Chemerinsky, who's quite progressive, said he was announcing to the world that he knows he has the votes on the Supreme Court to achieve his agenda and is committing to moving it forward. We're used to hearing agendas from political candidates, not judges, but we may be better off hearing him confirm his ideological biases rather than pretending otherwise. What do you make of this, that it's good for us to just know openly what Alito thinks? And can this then, can Alito being so open about his agenda give Joe Biden as president the cover that he needs to add more Supreme Court justices to the court? All he has to do is point to Alito's speech and say, I'm not trying to pack the courts. I'm simply trying to make it fairer, because we have, you know, a whole wing that's represented by Alito. And Alito made clear that his regressive views are out of line with the majority of the American public.
So there is something to be said to know exactly where somebody stands. What I have found incredibly frustrating for so many of the recent, you know, confirmations and in the hearings where nominees wouldn't comment on the law. It really is helpful to know where judges stand, because ideally what they can do is help improve the law. They are often the final arbiters of it. So there is something to be said about knowing where one stands. And I think you're, and as well as Dean Chemerinsky, are right to know where Justice Alito specifically stands and where we always suspected he does, where he's written about and what he has further given us even more clarity about last week, is that he does not stand on the right side of history. And we do have a lot of work to do to make sure that our courts are more fair, are more just, and do live up to what's written on top of the Supreme Court, equal justice under law. Whether or not that can be used as justification to expand the number of Supreme Court seats, there's, you know, a lot that can be done, you know, in terms of the Supreme Court, but also the lower courts in order to modernize them, keep up with caseloads, to make sure that they are reflective and representative of the amazing diversity that we have in our country. But there is, you know, something to be said about knowing exactly where he is and knowing that that is exactly not where we want to go. That can be emboldening for those of us who really see for exactly what he is, what he stands for, and how that is not where we are.
I want to thank you so much, Lena, for joining us today. Give out a website for your organization.
Certainly, it's civilrights.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Sonali. I appreciate it.
My guest has been Lena Zwarenstein, Fair Courts Campaign Director of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. We've been discussing how biased the U.S. judiciary has become toward conservative values. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.